We're on campus and we're online.
And we're online.
University.
Radio. Nottingham.
Welcome back to the film show. We're here for another hour of some great film discussion, and today we're talking a bit about some lovely gems from the 2000s. So maybe not the newest stuff, but we're, you know, going on the Oscars trail next show after Easter. And I am joined by, of course, Isaac and Lizzie. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
And we're going to actually start off with a lovely film that's only really been kind of been reappraised as, you know, as I suppose a 2000s gem. So Lizzie, do you want to start off with kind of a little synopsis of Jennifer's Body?
Yeah, so I picked Jennifer's Body for my 2000s gem because it's kind of going through a bit of like a renaissance at the minute where people are finally starting to appreciate it, myself included. I hadn't seen it until October last year when I decided to watch it like around Halloween. It's a great film. It's written by Diablo Cody, who previously made Juno, which is not a film I personally get on with, but high praise, you know, it's a film. And it stars Megan Fox as Jennifer Check, Amanda Seyfried as her friend Anita, who is also nicknamed Needy. Essentially what happens is Jennifer and Needy go to a bar to see an upcoming indie band called Low Shoulder. And it turns out that Low Shoulder maybe aren't what they appear to be. And they are actually looking for a virgin to sacrifice so that their band can kind of take off. They want to kind of do a trade with Satan, you know, sacrifice someone and get their band kind of famous. Through a series of events, they pick Jennifer. However, Jennifer is not a virgin. And what actually happens is that because she's sacrificed when she's not a virgin, a demon kind of starts to inhabit her body. And it basically kind of transpires that in order to stay powerful and healthy, she has to eat people. So I think that's like the most basic synopsis I can give of this film. It sounds really weird when you say it out loud.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
It's just such a strange one for me to say as a gem. But I think it's such an underrated film, and it was heavily mismarketed when it came out in 2009, mostly because studios felt it had to be marketed to teenage boys on the back of like Transformers and Megan Fox's success in Transformers. And instead, it's actually really aimed at, I would say, teenage girls mostly. And Diablo Cody, who wrote it, has said that is the intended audience. Kind of, you know, teenage girls and older, you know, like women in my demographic as well enjoy it. And it's really interesting because it's such a, it's got lots of really interesting themes in it for sort of horror. And I was kind of thinking about this the other day. We've had a sort of wave recently of female-led horror films that I think we would all agree kind of deal with, like there's the basic horror element, the basic storyline, and then they go and deal with something, you know, much deeper. So like, you know, Midsommar deals with, you know, kind of like grief and loss, as was Hereditary as well. You know, we've been talking about that recently in all of Ari Aster's films. And in many ways,
Babadook is probably like one of the best ones out of that.
Babadook as well,
definitely,
of course,
grief as well,
Yeah. I feel in many ways Jennifer's Body, even though it's definitely more comedic than those films because it is a horror comedy, it's kind of doing that same work and that same job. It's looking very closely at kind of female relationships and female friendships, how sometimes they can be, like, turn quite toxic, particularly during high school years. It's kind of looking at like the pressures on teen girls as well, particularly on popular girls, which I think it's fair to say Jennifer is, played by Megan Fox, obviously. And yeah, it's just such an interesting film, and I really, really like it. It really is getting into, like I say, a lot of stuff about kind of teenage girls, the pressure on them, the insecurity that breeds competition between them, even though, you know, they love each other and they're friends. There's definitely as well that, obviously, quite literally here, a sacrifice of a woman for male success. So it's very clear that Diablo Cody was tapping into that, definitely, I think, prior to some of the Me Too stuff as well that's come out recently. And I think because we have all this information now about the industry and Me Too and all that stuff, that's why Jennifer's Body is like having its moment now. Like, I think
I would completely agree. Like, I usually have a personal, like, I don't, you know, the idea of things being underrated or overrated, like, I usually don't like, because, like, usually for films or whatever media, I always think, whether I agree with if it's received positively or negatively, there's always a reason. But I do think that, like, this is like, this was underrated, and there's like the reason why is because of the mixture of it being really mismarketed And also, you know, to sort of a similar extent, sort of the backlash against like Megan Fox and, you know, Diablo Cody, like everyone thought, like, you know, like there was backlash against Juno because, like, oh, she's just overrated. Maybe she's an overrated writer because she won the Oscar for screenplay. Megan Fox, like Transformers, like, you know, no blame to her. She's not great in those couple of first ones, but.
She's not given much to work with.
Exactly.
Today.
Oh, definitely not. But, yeah.
I think I kind of didn't really have much interest, not because I thought it was like going to be bad, but I thought it looked pretty dumb or just had very little interest. So I only watched it for the first time for this, and I gotta say, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Like I think it, like, usually horror comedy is usually are better at either doing the horror or the comedy, but this is kind of in that rare breed of horror comedies that actually does well in both, and it doesn't feel like a tonal clash. Sometimes they could synthesize really well together, not just overall, but in like particular scenes and moments and character points. Like it's not just that, you know, apart from this film being really quotable, like I just have a long list of my favorite lines. And you're right, of all the things you've said, Lizzie, like I think a later assessment is because of everything we found out and sort of discovered and in sort of the Time's Up and the Me Too movement. I think that this film is not that, I think it's gotten better. It's, I think people have just realized, yeah, like this film was always good, you know, it was just really mismarketed, and like there was backlash, which you could argue was for sexist or misogynistic reasons.
I suppose that kind of thing, you know, set within the world of, I suppose, you know, teenage girls aren't the most beloved demographic for a lot of the filmmaking industry. Like they're certainly not looked on as a respectful audience, maybe treated with sort of flippantly, and setting, you know, even if it is a horror comedy, setting a reasonably, you know, serious film to an extent, but a film with, you know, that kind of those themes in it around that world, it sounds great. Like I definitely get why it's now coming up, and I really have to go out and watch it, because, you know, I do love a horror comedy, and this sounds really right up my alley.
There's actually, what I was noticing, maybe because I've just, you know, watched so many horror films over the years, but like, it's not like there are explicit references, but I think this film really does understand why certain, like, why horror works, like how to make an effective horror visually. Like, it's not just that it has like a fair share of blood and gore, like they didn't skimp on that, which, you know, is nice, but like right in the, like, the first scene in the film, one of the earliest scenes in the film, it has like a glide, like a point of view glide shot, and it reminded me very much of like an Evil Dead movie.
And also
like there was a few shots, which is actually something that still today is a very rare thing, but there was some sort of De Palma-esque split doctor shots, like if you watched Us a couple of years ago, they had like when two, like both sides of the frame are relatively in focus, like something you would get in Carrie, is famous for having it. But yeah, so I was thinking this film really knows like what it's doing, but for me personally, like I expected, you know, Amanda Seyfried as Needy, like I expected her to be, you know, good, because I think Amanda Seyfried is, you know, is very talented, and this film reminded me that, like, she can really do comedy well. But I think, to even as somebody who never saw this film, like it was really, I think this might be like Megan Fox's best role. Like I can't think of anything because, like, it's almost breaking the fourth wall. It's like using the kind of, like, using her, you know, her appearance and the way she looks, sort of, it's both, like, it as a weapon, in a sense of, like, she's early in the film, like, naively trying to get drinks, or, like, later when she, you know, she starts killing people. But, like, even, like, before she gets, like, even before she's, like, possessed and, you know, gets sacrificed, like, you can really feel the sort of insecurities of her character. It's, like, this very outward way of, like, trying to show confidence, but sort of, it's, like, but when you see, like, when a particular scene happens where she does that, you can sort of feel, like, she's projecting something. And honestly, like I know it's not the same film, but particularly, but like my favorite scene in a film like It Follows isn't like, you know, the big horror sequences or like, you know, the sort of the stuff where suspense and action happens, but it's simply early in the film where our main character is looking at herself in the mirror while disaster piece music is playing. And this, my favorite scene in the film, like in terms of like, you know, character building, was when Jennifer was looking at herself in the mirror, and she has like a picture of her before
yeah.
And she's just rubbing like all this like foundation, like so much, like it's almost like paint, just like this beige paint. And that was like more, like, as horrifying as like all the blood and gore in the film. Like it's quite something.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of my favorite scenes in the film as well. That kind of, it's interesting because like you sort of think, who has pictures of themselves like next to their mirror, which in itself is
on their road, not even with like their friends or family, just
not even
with
their friends, just a picture of her. But then the way I kind of read it was like, that's the standard that she holds herself to. Ooh, exactly. And she has to look as good as she does in that photo. And at the point where she's putting the makeup on, she's literally slapping this foundation on with her bare hands. She's kind of obviously in demon mode. She's not fed for a while and she's starting to look really unwell. And so this kind of this masking of trying to look better and okay. But I think that, again, it works really well. And I think this is why it works so well as a horror comedy, that particularly for teen girls especially, there's this, you know, huge standard of kind of, you know, you start to get into this understanding of what society is expecting and the kind of sort of bodily and beauty expectations put on women especially. And I think it's kind of people sort of push themselves to be that kind of ideal, and then they push away all of their insecurity, but it's always there. And I think that's what works so well about this as a horror comedy, is the comedic moments are almost like the kind of performative sheen of everything being okay and everything being fine, and then the horror is when this real insecurity comes out. So that's why, again, I completely agree, that's one of the best scenes in the film, even though it's just her putting makeup on, but it's also so much more than that. I think as well, it does borrow from kind of horror tropes as well. Like, I think maybe my favorite scene, I guess that is a close one, I suppose, that one with the makeup. But my favorite, I think, is when, without saying too much, Jennifer comes back from what we later realize is a sacrifice. And she comes to see Needy in the middle of the night, and she's not looking very good. And there's a lot of stuff happening to her. It's really like, that's kind of when the demon first starts to take over. And she just lets out this absolutely horrifying noise, like on the kitchen floor, that really put me in mind of The Thing. You know, that
that low growl kind of.
It's just so completely inhuman, and it's just so terrifying. And I thought that was fantastic. But then she's kind of, she barely even talks in that scene. She says a few words, but there's mostly just her kind of trying to process the whole thing. And she's kind of laughing, but it's on that point where it's almost crying. And like, she's just clearly in distress, but unable to like vocalize it. And I think that is, again, a really powerful look at what the sacrifice is in many ways an allegory for, which is assault and things like that.
The actual ritual sequence, like, it's not just this the sort of subtext of what it means, but, you know, simply as text, sort of as is, like, it's still, like, even for a horror comedy where horror is expected, it's horrifying.
The struggle, and, you know, as you're saying about the allegory of, like, this consent and assault, having that set, even if it is, you know, reasonably fantastical, I suppose, it's got demons and whatever in, that really bumps up that horror with it resonating with with the real world. So it's like, this is almost a slightly more of a trailblazer to an extent, of a lot of that female-led horror that does focus on those themes, which, you know, it's certainly great that it's come out.
I gotta say, like, I know it's like a lighter thing to talk about, but I just want to mention some of my favorite sort of supporting characters and sort of cameos in the film. So on the supporting character side, we have my boy Chip, you know, Needy's boyfriend. Chip. You know, he's lovely, he's kind, he's respectful, you know. Like, you know, he could be a bit annoying, but you understand why, because he does care for Needy. Also, that the Phil Collins joke in the film really hurt me, because it's like, you know, like, I've not heard of Phil Collins. But then you got Chris Pratt, who's basically playing a mix of Andy from Parks and Rec and his character from Zero Dark Thirty. Right. It's like, it's almost like he's playing like when Andy pretends to be like FBI. It's like, I just couldn't get it out of my head. But also, the best supporting character in the film, it's got to be J.K. Simmons as the teacher. Like, he's fat, he's got bad hairpiece, like, it's curly. It's like Gene Wilder's from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and he has like a claw hand. And the line he says when low shoulder are trying to like be like give this like image of caring about the community, when they say, when he says 3% of the profits will go to the families affected by loss. I'm like, 3%? Like, I know it's exaggerating, but it doesn't seem that like implausible for that to happen. Also, the low shoulder, like, they are like horrible people in the film, but like, I love that the film appropriately made like their music like really generic, like really like bargain bin, like mid to late 2000s indie rock. It really like made me realize like there is some 2000 nostalgia. I don't even know how to feel, like if it's good or bad. Also, Lance Henriksen, he's in it for one scene. I'm always happy to see Lance Henriksen in any movie.
That's definitely fair. Yeah, no, it's got a really good kind of supporting cast, I feel, in a lot of ways. And yeah, the band in particular, Low Shoulder, it's kind of worth saying, on the night that they take Jennifer, they actually kind of, I think they sort of deliberately set fire to the place that they are performing in. And then that kills a lot of people as well, and also kind of flushes out Jennifer, as it were, because she escapes the fire, but then obviously puts her in a state of shock where she's more suggestible, willing to come with them in the van, and so on. But because of the fire, the whole town is rocked by this massive tragedy. And that partly as well is what helps to skyrocket the band Low Shoulder, because their song Through the Trees, which is a terrible song.
I know, that's what I was saying. That song is awful.
Yeah. It kind of becomes like the anthem of healing for this town.
It's like We Are the World of this movie, you know, it like really is. Bad.
Yeah. And that's kind of why when they have that line about like 3% of profits will go to those affected, it's just so, it's so cutting. Like Diablo Cody absolutely did not come to play when she wrote this film. She really did. Okay, well, moving on from that then, we will have the track, because as you say, it is a soundtrack absolutely full of some real 2000s gems.
It's like Twilight, you know, where they put an all
amazing.
In there.
But my favourite track from it that I do believe is genuinely good. Sorry for anybody who likes Panic at the Disco. I've never been a huge fan. But genuinely good track from it. This is Florence and the Machine's Kiss with a Fist.
This is University Radio Nottingham.
Okay, and that was Kiss with a Fist by Florence and the Machine. We picked that from the Jennifer's Body soundtrack, which was our first gem from the 2000s for this show, the one that I picked, not that I'm biased or anything. The next film that we have is one that Isaac is bringing in. Isaac, do you want to talk about Children of Men?
So I've chosen Children of Men, which is sort of a bit more depressing than the other than Jennifer's Body Stardust.
And my pick later, yeah.
Yeah,
just a little bit.
So yeah, Children of Men is based off the P.G. James novel, and it's set in the not too distant future now of 2027. And in this world that the film sets up, is the world has become infertile. I think, like, you know, women are the people who can't, you know, no, I think it's, I don't know if it's men or women, but just basically the world can't reproduce and is infertile, and it's been the case for like this for 18 years. And sort of the film follows a former activist played by Clive Owen. His name is Theo Farron, and he's trying to transport the first pregnant woman to this thing called the Human Project, which is a sort of an organization where they're going to help reproduce the world. And they're trying to get her travel safely to a coastal town, as you know, they are stuck in this sort of authoritarian dystopian Britain. So I chose this film because, you know, unlike something like Jennifer's Body, where it got a later appraisal, or Stardust, where it's always kind of got general reviews, like this film was pretty well acclaimed when it came out. Like, you know, people like Roger Ebert and, you know, many others put this as like on their best films of the year. And some have put it on the best of their decade for the 2000s. Some for the even century. I think the BBC put it in like the top 20 of best films of the 20th century. And it got BAFTA and Oscar nominations on technical things like the cinematography. But I think now is in the part, it's 15 years old, this film, because I think it came out in 2006 or premiered then. There's obviously a lot of things have happened in the world. You know, we've had refugee and migrant crises, we've had, you know, terrorism, Brexit, you know, we've got COVID, there's been sort of a rise of populism and nationalism and xenophobia, you know, like anti-immigration sentiment just happened all across the world, and sort of, and, you know, images of refugees in cages and immigrants in cages. And I feel like this film sort of, I don't know, it's like obviously our world as of now, you know, people could still reproduce, but I feel like Children of Men is like one of the most prophetic films. Like, I know it's a cliche, but it is like, it has well predicted and sort of encapsulated a lot what happens in the past 15 years. And it's not like they predicted, obviously there were things, this film was obviously made post 9/11, the war on terror, you know, there was all these things going on sort of, you know, before the film was made and set. But it just, it feels like it's becoming more real. And I think one of the strengths of the film, I think this, well, in, especially in Clive Owen's performance, is that, you know, as this sort of ex-activist, he's sort of early, in the early stages of the film, especially in the first act, he's very cynical, he's very apathetic, he's fatalistic, he's nihilistic, he's somewhat of an alcoholic. Like, he says to Michael Caine in the film, like, even if they discovered a cure for infertility, it doesn't matter, because, like, the world is doomed. And then he says, like, it was too late already, even before it happened. And, and in a way, you know, it's a very, that's a very relatable thing. Like, and especially in the past 5 years, a lot of people, myself included, sort of felt this sort of helplessness and hopelessness, and that, you know, the world is just over, so why try? You know, it's like, in my lifetime, it's all over, so why try any harder? But I think, and the film could have easily have been that, and I still think it would have been a good film. I sort of, even though it could have been debatable if that's a good way of going about it, but through Clive Owen's character, is that there is a sliver of hope, however dire and dour Britain is or the world has become. Like, there's still that element of hope, and I think that's why I love this film so much. That, like, even with sort of how depressing it can be, it is a hopeful film, especially at the end. You know, sort of when the screen goes to black. I won't spoil it, but there's something that indicates there is. It may not be easy path, but there is still hope. And I think it's why one of the films I've most clung on to in the past year in COVID is that, even with everything that's going on, and there is still a sliver, however hard that may be.
Well, I watched it for the first time literally within the past 24 hours. I don't know, John, have you seen it?
Yeah, exactly the same. Yeah,
exactly. Watched it last night. So yeah. We're pretty fresh to it. Yeah. Yes. Gosh, it was stressful, wasn't it?
Oh, it certainly was.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Film doesn't mess about. Like, the first 5 minutes, there's an explosion in a popular London street. I think it was Fleet Street, Oxford Street, you know.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's strange. Like, I almost tackled it, you know, in watching it. I just couldn't believe it'd been made, almost. It felt, you know, the actual process of making this type of film with a huge world, and I mean, even logistically, the amount of extras, the timings, the incredibly long shots in natural light, it just seems like an impossible task to make this film. I can definitely see. I mean, I know it's loosely based off a novel, but bringing that onto the screen, bringing the whole world onto the screen, is a fantastic feat.
It's like, even though it feels like, you know, a wide scale sort of film, like, it's the way it depicts, like, you know, a near distant future. It's not like a super duper Blade Runner-esque future. Like, there's little tidbits that don't seem that, like, implausible, but just, I love it, like, just the information or the exposition of the film is told through, you know, the background, or you know, extras, or even just minor characters. Like, it feels very lived in and very sort of, like, you know, yeah, very lived in and very sort of weary. And even though there's still, you know, a great story and great characters, and, you know, it's like, I would say, like, the background, or sort of the visual exposition, or, like, you know, sort of some sort of news report, like, it does tell a lot of the story that we don't really need to know. Like, we never find the reason why the world has become infertile. And you could have easily made a film, like, you know, to find the cure, so we must find why it happened. But, like, the film isn't really interested in that kind of question, or that's not the point of the story. Like, it's what I've said before. It's about, you know, trying to get someone to a sort of promised land, almost. You know, the Human Project is depicted as this, like, you know, like, especially the end, it's like almost like, you know, like, it's like a light that's beaming through the fog.
Very much so. It's really interesting that you mentioned Blade Runner, because I was looking up stuff about this film today, and it was very much that I think they actually deliberately felt they were going to be the anti-Blade Runner, which is really interesting. I mean, because Blade Runner arguably is maybe slightly, you know, depicts one of the better, still quite lived in dystopian cities, but it is definitely very futuristic at the same time. Yes. Whereas this really feels like, you know, there's no flying cars or anything, you know, everything's just kind of
like
a bit differently shaped.
Like, there's some advancements in advertising, and maybe like that, sort of hand game one of the characters play. Like, it's like that could, like, I could see that plausibly existing in 5 years or so.
Definitely emphasizes the kind of decay rather than, I suppose, the futurism of Blade Runner. Like, it's almost vaguely, I know the film Elysium, it wasn't a fantastic film, but that kind of gritty nature to it as well.
Very grey.
It has that, definitely that really lived in feeling, yeah.
I would say also, like, I know I've mentioned Clive Owen. This is, again, my favourite performance. And I think, and Clive Owen's always an actor I always wish would finally, like, you know, he is such a good actor, and he's never had, like, that A-list status, or if he did, he had it for a very brief time. But like, there's some great supporting characters. Mm-hmm. So obviously Julianne Moore's in it for a short bit. You have Pam Harris as sort of like, it's almost like the picture, like she's the last midwife to ever exist. Chiwetel Ejiofor is sort of another activist. You got Danny Houston, but obviously the best supporting character in the film, Michael Caine.
Michael Caine's Michael Caine's completely always high but incredibly incompetent but also slightly lovable character. It's certainly, you know, maybe that's, I mean, it's a lovely film. It's not lovely, it's a great film for me, but I can certainly see that it has a few flaws, and Michael Caine's character being this kind of happy-go-lucky, you know, hopeful character, even despite the situation, I don't know whether that quite works for me. I know it's a great performance, really, Michael Caine coming out there, but I don't know whether it quite works for me.
I didn't think I was going to be doing this, but I think just on the spot, I would like to give a brief defense of the Michael Caine character, because I think what he represents maybe is obviously, I mean, we don't know when everything kind of went like downhill in this world. We know the last baby was born 18 years ago, and no one wants, but other than that, we don't kind of know sort of when everything really kicked off. And Michael Caine is definitely kind of more representative, especially when this was made in like 2006, of kind of that older, the older generation who sort of lived through the 70s and all that sort of stuff. And I think in many ways, what he is kind of serving is, I mean, there's a huge kind of thing going around that, you know, this is very much a film where you watch the background at all times and you listen to everybody in the background at all times. And there's this huge thing going on where they talk about being a British citizen, which is obviously very in direct contrast to the immigrants who are coming in. And there's this very big, like, you know, status, people, you know, if they want to be safe or anything, they literally yell, you know, British citizen, British citizen. Yeah. And I felt Michael Caine kind of, in many ways, sort of was there to kind of show us the slight privileges left to some British citizens who maybe had, you know, safe housing and their own mortgage and stuff and everything before everything kind of collapsed. Because he has an entire house that's just, yes, you know, yeah, for him and his wife and his dog. Whereas Clive Owen is living in a sort of massive London flat block. And so I think that was possibly what that was about. And I think as well, because he's the oldest character in the film, I think, in some ways it's a bit like, I don't know, kind of the contrast between the old and the young in some ways, where like the young have longer to live and they have more to fight for, whereas the old are like, I'm gonna make my little oasis and I'm gonna sit away from this and I have that privilege and I feel awful about it and I will do what I can to help, but at the same time I will retain that for the last years of my life. And that's, so I think point. That yeah, was
yeah. exactly it's almost
why
like,
he was included. He's like
In some ways, like, his optimism, it kind of is like the opposite of sort of Clive Owen, who earlier in the film, especially in like the first act, he's very much still, you know, he's like very apathetic. And obviously you find that sort of to some extent why he feels that way, or the progression to which. But like, as you said, the little things, and sometimes those little things could be, you know, the sort of music selection he has in his place, or like, obviously his occupation now in the film is that he produces weed and he just has lots of marijuana plants. But like, I remember, it's funny that you mentioned when you see Clive Owen's apartment, because there's an advert playing on his screen where it's for this product called Quietus, I think it was called, and it's basically like this thing which can basically, if you take it, you die. It's like a form of euthanasia. And in the scene, and then you actually see a box of Quietus in Michael Caine's apartment, because his wife is like, I don't know, comatose, or, you know, she's like mute.
It's almost like she's still been tortured. I think it's, she's actually a victim of the kind of crackdown on helping the refugees. I think she's a victim of that.
This film sort of shows like sort of the consequences of, even in the world, it's said, like, what happens when a country like Britain becomes not just isolationist but also very nationalistic. Like, that's kind of very ramped definitely. Up in both in its military and its kind of, you know, close to propaganda, like the things they project on screen, or like, you know, Britain soldiers on. It's a very kind of stiff upper lip World War II kind of mentality, but for something that's, you know, completely different. It's almost
harnessing that. It starts with an accent.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think maybe my problem with Michael Caine is, I don't know whether this film can be any more dour, especially, but that he still kind of helped. I don't know, maybe I would have felt better if that kind of, it's not quite opulence, but that this person who has the privilege of living in that house actually helps out. I don't know whether I would like him more if he was just held in his own little world and didn't care and was... So I suppose it's the idea of isolation that if England is isolated from the rest of the world's problems, they feel that they have to look after their own and their own exclusively. That Michael Caine can be like a microcosm of that and be selfish. And I don't know, I definitely see, you know, that the point of Michael Caine's character having that kind of contrast between old and new. But maybe for me, it could have been handled whether him being slightly meaner. I'm not sure.
I think I like that he does help people, not just because that's the kind thing to do, but because it kind of is like he creates this sort of oasis that it's almost like one of the few elements of joy left. And he kind of is willing to share that. Like when I kind of think of that character in that house, I think of Greece very specifically. Yes, yeah. Like it feels like it's the last place where life, whether that is human life or plant life or whatever, is actually thriving and is kind of existing. So it's almost like his contribution is to allow people to have that space again for a little bit of time, which is no mean feat in some ways.
Yeah.
I don't know. I really didn't think I was going to have a passionate defense of this.
But no, it's a great point. But the thing is,
there's something that's obviously kind of very much talked about in relation to this film is that, well, apart from it being, I think, Alfonso Cuarón's, I think might be my favourite of his films, like both you know, English and non-English language work. I also think it's the cinematographer Emmanuel Lubezki's best work. Like, you know, I know he's famous, but like, obviously he's done this throughout his career as a DP, but like the long shots he do, they're not just impressive because they're long or they're elaborate, especially sort of the car chase scene or like the big sort of battleground finale. Like it feels purposeful. I don't feel like it's showing off. Like there actually is a purpose to these sort of long takes that he does. Like it's almost like this film, like, you know, kind of in tone of how it looks and how it kind of feels and thinks, it's like it's very much like the sort of documentarian handheld quality that's in the film works in its favor. Like it doesn't feel like, oh, it's just trying to be real, so, you know, let's make it real or feel realistic by, you know, doing it handheld. Like, there's a purpose to it being handheld.
Yeah, definitely. I think in terms of the story, if I had one thing that I would pick out, I think it is the fertility crisis, just because I didn't know whether it was, or it kind of felt like that. I think Like the flip side to this would be something like The Handmaid's Tale, where the fertility crisis is made the main thing of the entire story. And then this was almost like everything's terrible and there's a fertility crisis. It was kind of in the background almost, even though the main sort of A to B plot of this was let's get this pregnant woman from A to B. And I don't know, I think in some ways I felt that was dropped a little bit because there were kind of, I mean, I said this when we talked about it earlier between ourselves, that there were kind of points where I felt things were stretched a little bit. Like the woman who is pregnant, Key, she says that she wasn't prepared for or didn't understand some aspects of pregnancy. And I couldn't quite believe that because I felt that... I don't know, like, you know, these kind of health issues, particularly among cisgender women, that's very much a communal thing. And I feel even in a dystopia or something, there would be this kind of communal knowledge passed down throughout the years.
Yeah,
even, like, I mean, the last baby was only 18 years ago. I know that's quite a while, but it's not long enough for everybody to forget their collective memory of what happens. And I think in some ways,
it's like, well, YouTube does exist. Like, is there no like e-how video to do this? I mean, but like this, just Clive Owen goes on his phone. Oh, e-how, how do you deliver a baby?
How to deal with this? I think in some ways that would be my flaw for it. And I said this in a slightly like, it feels like it's written by men way, but it does a little bit where I felt there were lots of groups of organized men, which made a lot of sense, but not many groups of organized women. And they were just kind of, the women in the film are kind of here, there and everywhere. And I think in a fertility crisis, women would band together.
Oh,
I feel that would be very very much communal knowledge. So when they kind of were like, I don't know about pregnancy, I was like, what are you talking about? But I think that's maybe the element that I struggled to believe in, I think. But other than that, it is great.
The author of the original book does make a cameo in the film right in the first scene in the cafe. Like, she's the old lady in the front of the store. I don't know if you noticed that, but that's a cameo from the author.
That's
yeah.
I feel bad.
So, did you guys enjoy the film overall, though?
Yeah. It's really, really good. It's so rich in kind of just the whole world building. I mean, like I say, you really cannot take your eyes off the background at any given moment. It's giving you so much information.
You know, for a film that's in the 2000s film, I think this is one of the best films of that decade. And I think it's Caron's best. I know he's done lots of great films. Frater's Creator, Why Mambi Tambien, Prisoner of Azkaban, you know, Gravity, Roma recently. Like, they're all, you know, good films in a row. But something about this film, maybe it's just my love of sci-fi, or maybe because I just like dystopian Britain stories, because, you know, feel that. That feels very
British. It's a very British film. You can definitely feel it coming through. Yeah. So, yeah, we're going on to our second track of the day.
Yes, I really want to. So, yeah, there's lots of great songs in this film. There's Hush by Deep Purple. There's, I think, Ruby Tuesday's in there. But I'm going to recommend my favourite song in this film. And it's from one of my favourite albums of all time. This is King Crimson's In the Court of the Crimson King.
On campus.
And online.
This is
URN.
Yes, that was In the Court of the Crimson King by King Crimson. Our final film for today for our 2000s selection. I think we've got a lot of late 2000s choices, but I think our final one is something a little more uplifting than Children of Men. So, John, introduce Stardust to us.
Yes, so Stardust is a film. It follows Tristan, played by Charlie Cox, wonderfully with Charlie Cox, some wonderful outfits, I've got to say.
He's absolutely so baby based in this film. He looks like such a kid.
Who lives in the town called Wall, which is kind of on the boundary, on the border between a kind of magical kingdom and kind of the normal mundane kingdom. And it's kind of Tristan's journey to find and bring back a fallen star for kind of the person that he's trying to woo. And it turns out that Claire Danes is the star, that she'd been knocked out of the sky by a flying stone. It sounds really, really kind of complex, but it's essentially almost, I was saying Children of Men's a bit of a road trip. This is a kind of road trip going to, from place to place in the
It's very much a hero's journey type.
Oh, definitely. And Claire Danes being knocked out of the sky by a stone that has been propelled from the castle where seven sons of a king are fighting for the throne, and the seven sons played by some wonderful British actors, and I've really got to pick out Mark Strong. He really knows to be in that role. He doesn't let it slip at all. It's fantastic. And it follows Charlie Cox and Claire Danes traveling through this fantastical world to get back to Wall and kind of finding out some about themselves along the way. I can accept that I might have nostalgia goggles on to a certain extent.
It's fine.
Because this was in a very, very, you know, I realised watching it back, because I haven't watched it for absolutely ages, how much I've just is seared into my brain about Stardust. And it's very strange because, you know, I can admit it's maybe not the, a critically acclaimed film. It has, I know that's a strong choice me saying that, but I can see that it just being a fun kind of journey with all these, you know, fantastic elements, and really it's based off and actually, you know, was written, you know, the actual as a screenwriter, they got Neil Gaiman, who wrote the original stuff, and I love Neil Gaiman. And you can see the kind of the Pratchett, the Terry Pratchett coming in, and I'm a Terry Pratchett nut. And you can see that the comedic, but also kind of slightly, you know, it's tongue in cheek.
I suppose it's very tongue in cheek. It's tongue in cheek, but it's very sincere.
It reminded me
a lot of the Princess Bride. You know, it's not there's no cynicism or snark. It's like it's a very sincere, big budgeted fantasy story. And I do think, obviously, this came out in the 2000s. This was obviously post Lord of the Rings. You know, the mass success of that of the trilogy, and obviously because of that, such a plethora of there was a lot of fantasy films or fantasy adaptations. Yes. And you know, obviously you had like obviously there were big successes like the first couple of Narnia movies. You had something like Aragorn, which wasn't as big a success. I bet there's a bunch of The Golden Compass, the first adaptation of his Dark Materials. Like there was a lot of them, and a lot of all that. It was also Harry Potter, so you have all this like a lot of them trying to be the next Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter, and they just a lot of them not fully working. But even though it's, I don't think it's on the same level as something like the Lord of the Rings trilogy, even though it's a very different kind of fantasy, it is a very enjoyable sort of film. Like it's got the fantasy, it's got witches, it's got pirates, it's got floating ships, kings, queens, voodoo at one point, you know, like there's like I don't know how they just dropped in voodoo, I don't mind. Yeah, and lots of British accents apart from De Niro, who didn't feel like doing one that day.
But one thing I love about the film is how, you know, it just accepts that magic is real. Like it just straight up like just dunks you in, like stars are people, well not people, they're kind of slightly people who also glow, and also there's witches and princes that bleed ghosts. Blue blood and ghosts, and it's just you think it would always be overwhelming if they tried to try to introduce it with a slightly more kind of, you know, it's sincere, but trying to introduce it in the way that maybe Lord of the Rings would
there's three plots going on. You obviously have Charlie Cox, you have Tristan, who's obviously trying to impress this lady Victoria played by Sienna Miller, and he wants to find its location because, you know, if he doesn't, he won't be able to be, you know, I think, I don't know if it's marriage but a relationship, because she wants to be with this other guy. And this is what's hilarious, like I remember Charlie Cox was in this movie, like I remember, like, oh, you know, we have Daredevil in his one of his early roles, but I had completely forgotten that Henry Cavill was there. Yeah, he played like played like Ralph Fiennes from Curse of the Were-Rabbit. It's real like sort of slimy British dude with like, you know, blonde hair and a mustache. So it's basically just Daredevil versus Superman.
So you have that going on, trying to find.
I don't think any character is in any way bland. Every single character has the ultimate kind of archetype.
And then also you have the witches. You know, obviously you've got to have three witches.
I've completely forgotten my synopsis. And it's so packed full of
three witches who are led by Michelle Pfeiffer. They want to sacrifice this star, you know, that is represented by Claire Danes, so they could become eternally youth. Like early in the film, they have someone like, you know, something like that prior, and they eat like the remnants of their heart, and that's what makes her, you know, look like Michelle Pfeiffer and not like, you know, I don't know how to like a witch essentially.
Yeah, it's great how they just pack in all this kind of magical stuff, and it's really, you know, it's both, you know, a real kind of fun and bouncy adventure, but it does occasionally take its time. You know, it can slow down occasionally and have, you know, there's certainly not the deepest character interactions, and I can admit that it's not. It is not an especially deep film, but
I think in some ways that has to do it a slight disservice, because we've talked about quite a lot of big topics today, and I feel in many ways the thing that's kind of at the heart of Stardust is kind of about learning to let yourself grow, I feel, in a lot of ways. Like I think Tristan kind of starts out with this quest of, I'm going to go get the star so I can woo Victoria, and then I'm going to marry Victoria, and that's going to be my life. And he has to realize and reckon with the fact that the experience he's going through is changing him. And I think that's probably what the story is actually about in some ways. Just to give it some credit.
Yeah. I suppose, definitely. Yeah. And that's going on this kind of wacky, it's maybe not wacky, but this adventure changed you. Great. Yeah. And I'm just trying to think back, and sometimes, no, it's difficult to talk about Robert De Niro because he's done a few not great films. But
no, you don't,
it's
so say.
Strange, but I think Robert De Niro's performance here, I love it.
He's so great. Like, he was so easy. Again, so I know it's, I joke that he didn't do an accent, but his character as Captain Shakespeare is like, it is almost like the highlight of the film, in my opinion.
Yeah.
At first, you think he's going to be this rough and tough, like, you know, captain, and then like afterwards he's like this like dude who's all kind of very like flamboyant, and he wants to hear about England, like it's this mythical land, and he has like a walk-in wardrobe of all these lovely suits and dresses.
Aside from maybe a few cheap jokes, though, he is like a wonderful, you know, he's a wonderfully caring character, and I think they definitely kind of played it in a very, very much, you know, almost a nasty way of playing this kind of, that he's putting on artifice and whatever. But I love how, you know, Robert De Niro has this wonderful kind of resting acting that he can be this kind of gentle presence. And I don't know, I just feel so much, you know, joy just from watching him. And it just shows that what a wonderful actor he can be occasionally when he tries. But Robert De Niro, I just love him so much. Like, really holds a place in my heart. And it's maybe not the best on a film criticism show to say that I can't, like, I maybe can't objectively talk
about. No, you're
about
right.
The film.
You're right. Like, in terms of pace.
I was gonna say, I think the thing about it is kind of, because I agree, I've got a lot of nostalgia for Stardust as well, but I kind of think, like, it kind of doesn't matter, like, you know, like, it's kind of one of those films where, like, you don't need to think about it critically, it doesn't want you to. Like, I, when we've been sat here talking about Captain Shakespeare, I've not seen this film for quite a while.
Same, like 10 years plus.
I'm 90% sure that Captain Shakespeare gives Tristan a sort of like makeover, if you will, where he gives him a haircut and his hair actually gets long.
I want those scissors so bad.
Does
like,
that
happen?
Love it.
Magical scissors. I want those magical scissors.
You know, it kind of knows just to have fun. You know, that's such a ridiculous thing, and yet it's just there to be joyous and
just, that's what that's you smile.
It has a unicorn have a fight with a goat. You know.
Probably,
like, and the goat when it's transformed into a human is played by Ron Weasley's dad, and he still acts like a goat, and he's got a goatee.
It's almost
literally
got that kind of Horrible Histories-esque. I don't know. It's a very, directed by Matthew Vaughn, who's done, you know, a lot of different films.
Lots of things.
More recently, Kingsman. Mm. But I think that the very, you know, Kingsman to me, I don't like that too much. We can kind of see where it's going. Had the connections with that in Twilight, that it can have these moments of levity, but I think it's definitely worth a watch, and it's unlike a lot of films, you know. Trying to put that in an actual grammatically correct way, but it's not like a lot of films. Like, you can see, I think Isaac was talking about the rise of the kind of fantasy genre in the 2000s, but it's so aside from that, and it's almost got that kind of slightly more Terry Gilliam-esque kind of stuff where it is.
Yeah, like, some people have compared it to like stuff like Time Bandits, and it's kind of very.
It's got an element of
Time Bandits.
Yeah.
I could talk about Stardust for, three more years. But I think it's about time we round off the show. We're going to play If It'll Take That, which is the kind of the standout track from it. And I'm sure it was probably number one for quite a while, or at least in the charts, which is Rule the World, which is, you know, I guess we're a radio station, we're allowed to play radio hits. But yeah, we'll play a bit of that. But because we are part of URN, University of Nottingham, we're having a break for Easter, and we're going to come back for our Oscar special, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. It's going to be an interesting Oscar special this year.
Yeah, everything's
so
out.
So many of the films are not available for us to watch yet.
Yeah, legally. You know, like Judas and the Black Messiah is like it for the moment.
Yeah. We're going to try our hardest to watch our best. We'll do our best. But we'll come back with that. I believe that will be around
Middle of April.
Middle of April. There we go. But we'll put that on our Twitter and Instagram at @UN_filmshow. And yeah, we'll see you lot. You'll hear us after the Easter holidays. I hope you've enjoyed our little trek into the 2000s in some lovely hidden gems. But yeah, we'll leave you off with a little bit of Take That with Real World. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye. DJ!
This is URN
University
Radio
Nottingham.